Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, well, not with me, in San Francisco, is digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. And academic and DJ Oliver Wang.
Hey, Guy.
Hello, Oliver. I don't know why I went back to the paper. Every week, we start the show by taking a question from a listener about our own pop culture tastes. This week, I want you guys to tell me, what is the first thing you bought with your very first paycheck? Winner, what's the first thing you bought?
My own phone line, so I can not have to deal with my mother's bullshit at home.
And she was okay with that?
No, she was completely upset about it. And not only that, is that like I started using it to call video dating lines.
Oh, yes.
But I wanted them to be on my bill, so that's why I did it.
Wait, what?
Did you have a princess phone?
No, I had like one of those. It was like the dawn of the new world. So I had like a cordless one I can walk around the house and antagonize my parents with. It was amazing. And it got voice messages on it. So it was amazing. It was like $200.
What's a video dating line?
It's one of those where you call and you pretend to be older like I did. And then it was the ones they showed the commercials and then you would call and pretend to be an adult. So not a video dating one, but
right.
like those party
It was advertised
lines.
Like that, yeah.
There were chat rooms that were actual chats.
Exactly.
Yes. Margaret, what's the first thing you bought?
I was about 14 and I ran this like babysitting group for a church. And so the paycheck was basically like some parent writing me like $40 for that Sunday or whatever.
Yeah.
And I went and took that check and cashed it at the bank. And I bought myself this black suede bucket purse. And I was totally like, I have arrived, people. Check this out. It was the first purse I ever bought myself. And I met some friends later that day at the frozen yogurt shop, and I left it behind.
No!
Because I wasn't used to carrying a purse yet. And then 20 minutes later, I realized the grand error of my ways. I ran back, and somebody had stolen my purse out of this frozen yogurt place. So
they didn't waste no time.
I know.
I mean, it seems like the worst part of parenthood is just being mad at your child because of all of the coats that they lose. Because, like, children are just...
They lose everything.
Gonna lose coats.
And
not mine.
And scarves.
And if she knows what's good for
purses.
Her.
Oliver, what's the first thing you bought?
I love this question. I can't remember. I mean, my first job that I got paycheck for was delivering papers back when I was in early high school. And, I mean, my parents raised me with a very conservative kind of fiscal policy, which is that anything I earned went directly into the bank. And it's not that I couldn't spend my own money, but I was pretty much encouraged not to. And so I don't think – it wasn't like I was saving for some kind of big ticket item or anything along those lines. So to answer this question, I have a long-term purchase plan in place for whenever I get promoted to full professor, which probably won't be for another 2.5 years. But I want to get a pair of – Shell Cordovan wingtip boots, which will probably set me back somewhere between $800 to $1,000, which is why I'm not doing it as an impulse, but I have to tag it to some kind of like promotional raise boost.
Right.
And I can blame that on our sister show, Put This On, which is also produced out of Maximum Fun, because they're the ones who have seduced me with like the idea that I need Shell Cordovan wingtip boots in my life.
Are those insurable?
They ought to be at the price I'm paying for them. Shit.
Yeah, or you need to get like remarried.
Yeah.
So that's like a wedding purchase.
Yes. tell your wife.
I mean, yeah, get married again to the same woman.
Right.
My first job was working construction for my dad, and I would immediately just give my check to my mother, because that's why you have a gay son, is just the unquestioning obedience to his mother. but like about halfway through the year, I like finally was like, I would like to buy something. And she was like, what? And it was a B-52's EP that had Love Shack and Rome on it. For some reason, I didn't just buy the entire Cosmic Thing album until like a year later. But I was like, I would like the CD that has those dancing ladies who are all of those colors on it. And my mother allowed me to purchase it.
And where'd you buy it from?
Oh, I bought it from, like, the record store at the mall, you know?
Like a Sam Goody or...
Yeah.
They, yeah.
It was just, like, a little tiny... This was before we even, like, got, like, a Sam Goody that, like, occupied, like, 4 mall spots. This was just, like, one of those one mall spot record stores. Well, thanks to Adam Painter for tweeting that question to us. Coming up in this week's show, of course, we're going to be talking about the Emmys. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Oliver Wang, what are you all about this week?
I went to go see Black Mass, which is the new Johnny Depp film where he plays Jimmy Whitey Bulger, the Boston gangster who was on the lam for close to 20 years and was finally caught in 2011 outside of a bungalow in Santa Monica. And he'd basically managed to hide out despite having, you know, 10 murders on his record and being on top of the FBI's Most Wanted. I have to say, I mean, it may not necessarily enter into the pantheon of great gangster films in the same way that, you know, Goodfellas and Godfather is there, but I thought it was really well done. And more importantly, given how bad Johnny Depp's track record has been of, let's say, the last 5 years or so, this was really the first, like, straight up bona fide, really good, like, performance he had. I mean, he was fantastic and pure menace. I mean, this was not like a kind of Tony Soprano-esque, semi-flawed, somewhat sympathetic character. He was just like, and it wasn't like, I mean, you could say pure evil, but it wasn't like he was very human, but in like a really just not good way. And,
Do you think we should separate Johnny Depp and Tim Burton? Have we let him be around people who will indulge his weirdness too much? Do we need to like get him to make like real movies again?
I'm trying to walk through how many times they've collaborated, and of those collaborations, which one of them were completely solid, and which ones can we really just throw out? And really, besides, I mean, was Edward Scissorhands was one?
Edward Scissorhands,
and
is
then
great.
What else besides that have they done well together with?
I mean, I liked Sweeney Todd, but like, you know, there's a lot of Alice in Wonderland, there's a lot of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
But you
in
can't blame Burton for Transcendence, you know, or that.
No,
kind of,
but like you can, because it lulled Johnny Depp into this sense that he can do anything, and even if it's not Tim Burton, he can just do anything that's whimsical and quirky and weird and dysfunctional.
Well, and isn't that kind of great? I mean, I thought his Pirate in Pirates of the Caribbean is one of the best performances he's done.
Oh yeah, no question.
It was amazing, and that he got nominated for an Oscar for a Pirates of the Caribbean movie is testament to his raw skill. But I feel like us
did maybe, he?
Yeah, I
just didn't win.
I don't,
but
I don't remember whether it was the first or second, but he got nominated for one of them as best actor. But the thing is making four or five of those movies convinces somebody that
he ran it into the ground.
His talent is scarves. Like, and that man at this
and
point,
black
strategic.
Eyeliner.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Thank
you. That sounds great. Winner, what are you all about this week?
I'm really into Fear the Walking Dead. I haven't had a chance to talk about it because it's been so crazy and everything else has been going on, but there's a lot of problems with this actual show because it basically has decided to exist in a world where no one knows what zombies are. They've never seen a zombie show. There's no such thing as zombies. So the response to it is supposed to be as if it's a natural response to an unnatural situation, but imagine a world where people didn't think that the dead could walk again, and they've never been presented with an example of it.
So this is a prequel then. This is us like in the world of Walking Dead right when the shit goes down.
Yeah, this is day zero, and this is takes place. We're estimating it's either 2 years or 6 months before the actual Walking Dead began. Because if you look at a lot of the things in the show, it's pretty dated. And I'm terrible at being observant when I'm absorbed in a story, but there's apparently a lot of calls to the fact that it's about 4 or 5 years ago, six or 5 years ago.
So what do they actually describe the zombies as, if not as zombies?
No one has called them dead. The only person who's called them dead is a crackhead. Everyone else is just like, they're sick, they're infected, they have a disease. They won't say zombie, they won't say they're dead. And even 4 episodes in, no spoilers, maybe a spoiler, but like the father of the stepfather father of the whole main cast still doesn't seem to believe that anything is actually that wrong. He feels like there's just a national emergency that's being responded to by the military and the hospitals, and it'll get dealt with and everything will be fine because the power still works and the water still runs. It's really weird.
Getting horror and to a lesser extent sci-fi, where people do chafe at the disjuncture from reality in a way that feels real seems hard. Like, we, just because you have to get to the business of killing vampires or zombies or whatever, it feels like you don't get that real sense of, like, how you would react if you saw somebody turn into a bat or be a zombie.
I always feel like zombie shows on some level are always about drugs. Like, I think it's interesting that it's a crackhead that plays a big function in the story, because I feel like a lot of what zombies are about is analogous to what somebody is like when they're totally addicted and, like, their personality has, like, left their body. I really do. I think there's some kind of relationship there between, like, drug addiction and zombies, crackheads. You know, it's like it's I don't know. It's all related to me.
I think it's interesting when they put people in this position. They did this in the Evil Dead remake, where you're supposed to be thrown off. Is this what this person is really experiencing because they're also on drugs? I think it's really fascinating that the main character is a very, very big junkie. We're not talking about, like, for the purposes of television junkie. He is, he's a really
like waking up and lighting the crack pipe.
Like waking up, lighting the crack pipe, woke up in a drug, like the nastiest of drug dens in the first episode. And he's literally like, it's not a spoiler, it happened on Sunday, but like intravenously taking in morphine from sick patients. Like, he is a junkie. So the fact that you can't decide, but because he's witnessed this in concert with like other people that are not out of their minds, he still is the one that people don't believe anything he says, and he's the first one to call attention to this. So it's very like, it's not enough gore for me yet. It's not enough, you know, for somebody who witnesses zombies. You know, if I saw somebody walking down the street and I would know it was this person was dead if their jaw's missing. So there's not enough of that yet. It's really still sort of building up his character, who the characters are. But I like it. I just love anything zombies. We know this, but it's really good.
This is a bit of a tangent, but I really feel like there was a missed opportunity for some television studio not to produce World War Z, the book, not the movie version, which really bears very little in common with the actual source material.
Yeah.
And turned into a television series, because it was – I mean, it was so rich in what you could do with it.
It was so taking that book, which was about so many different people experiencing something in so many different ways, and turning it into a magnificent story of one proud hero who proud heroes for us.
Yes.
Was really – I mean, I didn't watch the movie because it felt like it
wasn't
related to –
You didn't see World War Z?
It wasn't a bad movie, but it bore so little resemblance.
I liked the book so much, and I was like, if there's not going to be a lady jet pilot, I don't care anymore.
You got to see the movie just so you can be really angry about how different it is. It's from the book. It's like it's
they don't share anything in common
at all.
The title. So,
this week I am all about telling Oliver Wang you were right. And everyone else who insisted that I watch Borgen and that I needed to watch Borgen and that how I could not have watched Borgen was stupid.
You've been Borgenized?
I've been Borgenized. So Borgen is a Danish drama that is basically The West Wing, except in a country of 5.6 million people where you can be prime minister and also you have to clean up your own kitchen. And you have to figure out how your kitchen gets cleaned. And it's such a wonderful show. Like, it is both wonky and processy in a way that feels organic. Like, I think there are two types of political shows. There's, like, The West Wing, which tries to – I mean, sure, it's idealized and you're getting an actual liberal in the White House and stuff, but you're still dealing with the actual nuts and bolts of how things work. And then you've got, like, your Scandal or Commander-in-Chief – where it's somebody who doesn't really think about politics deciding that they're going to set something in a political world. Like, I've never watched Madam Secretary, but I imagine if I watched it, I would just get mad at it for not understanding how politics works. And Borgen is a show that is deeply about politics and about trading horses and gives you, like, as somebody who loved The West Wing, it is so great to have a lady who doesn't have the majesty of the White House behind her, who really is – there's – the best episode is third or fourth episode. The issue is the CIA has been bringing Guantanamo detainees through Greenland. And it, like, so beautifully, like, compares the relationship between Greenland, this colonized possession of Denmark that nobody really thinks about, and the United States and Denmark. Like, the United States really, like, not giving a shit what Denmark thinks about anything and being ready to just roll over their democracy if necessary. It's terrifying to watch, and it's really weird to watch as an American, and I can't get enough of it.
How far in are you now?
I am now at episode, like, 8 of the first season. So I'm real worried about poor Birgitta, her marriage and her majority. Like, it feels like either of them could fall apart at any time. What was your experience watching the show?
I mean, I really loved it. And I don't remember who suggested that I start watching it. But, I mean, once we started – and this was – I think after season 2 had ended, so me and my wife went back and binge-watched the first 2 seasons, and then when season 3 came out, we sort of watched that in kind of normal sequential order. And I just thought it was incredibly well cast, well acted. And I think much like you, Guy, the fact that it focuses so much on a parliamentary government, which I have no experience with being in the United States, it was just fascinating to see a political process that's outside of like the House and the Senate and basically the thing that you get from Washington shows all the time. It was just – I felt educated that, oh, okay, this is how a parliamentary system works, which is how a lot of the other parts of the Western world works.
I mean, the thing to me that is fascinating is just the scale of it. Like, one of the main characters is the anchor of the like, state-run news. And, like, realizing what state-run news is like in a country the size of Minnesota. Like, how little it is, how personal these relationships are. Also, everyone, with the exception of our prime minister, everyone just lives in, like, an apartment. Just like
But like an IKEA apartment. Yeah, like, very well-furnished.
A well-furnished apartment, but, like, media stars and also just, like, people who work. It's pretty great.
So, by the way, did you recognize how the anchor that you're talking about was a sound machine from Pitch Perfect 2?
Yes.
Which I thought was hilarious to see her reappear.
Well,
it's like
weird
that.
Watching a TV show 5 years after it happened in America, consumed it, and we're like, who's the pretty one who we will bring over here and make famous? I will never forget watching All About My Mother and being like, oh, that like simply gorgeous Penelope Cruz, it's so sad that she won't become famous because we're all going to go crazy over Candela Pena because she's a better actress. Because I don't understand how America works. But yeah, like – absolutely gorgeous blonde girl. And I was like, well, yeah, we have to have put her in something. Oh, it was Pitch Perfect, too. Yeah, I should have realized. Margaret Wampler, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about Joe Mino's new novel, which is called Marvel and a Wonder. Mm. People who like Cormac McCarthy are going to really love this book. It's set in 1995 on a farm in Indiana, and it's a grandfather, very stoic and taciturn, who doesn't really like work with his emotions too much, working on this farm with his grandson, who was pretty much abandoned there by his mother. And the two of them are in this sort of uneasy rapport, and all of a sudden this horse shows up. A horse is delivered to them, this gorgeous, giant, white racing mare. And it has this kind of mystical portent in the book. Like, it basically becomes this catalyst for, like, other things in the book to happen. Eventually the horse – this isn't ruining anything. This is on the back cover of the book. But eventually the horse gets stolen, and the boy and his grandfather go on this chase after the horse. And the criminals that are sort of involved in stealing the horse – it reminded me a lot of, like, Fargo, mm-hmm. Coen Brothers. There's some comedy to it, but it's also really dark. And overall, the book is just very – it's very concerned with masculinity and what it means to be a man and sort of stepping up. It also is really concerned with, like, these sort of down-and-out people in America. Uh-huh. On, like, every level, every socioeconomic level, every race level. And it's – I don't know. It's just a really great book. It has very beautifully described passages of, like, watching this horse race across the landscape. It's pretty magical.
I tend to get so tired anytime I am dealing with boy on a farm. Like...
I know. I hear you. Like, okay. When I first started it, I was a little bit like, okay, this has got to do something to the story or else I'm going to get bored. And I mean, there's a couple of twists to it in the sense that, like, for one thing, the boy is biracial. The dad's not. Or sorry, the grandfather's not. The grandfather is white. The boy is half black, half white. There's some kind of tension he experiences in the town that's totally different from what his grandfather knows because, you know, he's living in sort of a different reality. And, you know, there's that twist to it. And then it's just so beautifully described and dives down so deep into their relationship that it really does manage to just sort of like blow out that kind of worry that it's going to stick to these tropes that you've seen before.
All right.
What else has Mino written?
This is probably his like fifth or sixth novel. Mm. Hairstyles of the Damned was a big one for him. If you saw the cover, you'd probably recognize it. He wrote another book a couple years ago called The Great Perhaps. He just keeps getting better and better, so it's great to see him growing. I mean, starting in an already great place and growing.
Nice. Well, guys, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back to talk about the 67th Emmy Awards right after this.
This is Erin from Columbus, Ohio. I listen to Bullseye because every week I am introduced to a new movie, book, song, video game, or idea that I never would have discovered on my own. And I gain new insights into the things I already love.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to the singer-songwriter Bill Withers, he of Lean On Me and Ain't No Sunshine, on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Hello, L.A., Boston, Brooklyn, Manhattan, Philly, D.C. Bullseye is going on the road this November for our world tour of several American cities. See live interviews, music, comedy, and more. Check out bullseyetour.com for more information and get your tickets starting Friday, September 25th. That's bullseyetour.com. See you there.
Welcome back to Pop Rockin'. I'm your host, Guy Branum. In San Francisco is
Winter Mitchell.
And here in the studio with me are
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
And last night was the 67th Primetime Emmy Awards, hosted by Andy Samberg. Do you guys think he did a good job?
He was really good.
I think he was solid.
I think he did a really, really good job. It's been since the Golden Globes that we had a good award show monologue. And his monologue was on point. The categories are a little bit different. Now, Orange is the New Black has gone from drama to comedy, and Louis has gone from comedy to jazz. like, I was just like, it was beautiful. It was really, really funny. And he had a sense of playful confidence. And I know that our thousands of straight white guys who do this sort of thing are all giving us, like, charming, awkward confidence. But at least he was able to get it done. Oliver, thoughts?
Yeah, I just think his goofiness, which is has been one of his calling cards since he first emerged, it really works in a hosting situation because he's not really taking himself or the job that seriously. So when he does well, that it seems really good. And when things falter, like he can kind of fall back on his sort of self-deprecating goofiness as a way of kind of getting out of these awkward moments.
Last night made me realize in a way I had never realized before how much tooth size is important to Andy Samberg's persona and career. Like, it's an attractive enough Jew with teeth that are just large enough that you're like, yeah, you can't take him seriously.
That big goofy grin.
And I love Seth Meyers, but there was the moment when they were out there together doing the thing for Lorne Michaels because Lorne Michaels
got outpowered. He got outshined.
He needs to be blown more. But like seeing like Seth just sort of be like linear and pencil-like and in his adorable tuxedo, and then Andy Samberg who was wearing playful outfits and understood that even if you're a boy, you have to have some costume changes.
My only detracting remark about Andy Samberg is that I just don't feel like he quite has, like, been around the block and earned it.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there's this feeling with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler that they have, like, been around the block and seen some things and whatever. And I just don't have that feeling with Andy Samberg, and I kind of miss it. Like, I kind of miss the sort of, like, I have real gravitas, I have experience, like, I got some stories to tell you.
Well, I mean, it's why they're so perfect for the Golden Globes, because they are sort of like the blousy, gossipy broads at the blousiest and gossipiest of award shows. The rest of the awards felt a little creaky to me. Like, the presenter copy was particularly bad.
Yeah. Who wrote that?
You're talking about the Emmys, not...
At the Emmys, okay. Yeah. Particularly poorly presented. And it just...
Yeah, pretty stiff, everyone's reads.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and what
like,
was... What,
but Terrence Howard...
Yes, thank
I mean,
you. What was that supposed to be? I don't get what... I don't know what the joke was there.
Yeah, like, it was one of those, like, I assume that he messed up in some way. I was honestly just looking at Taraji P. Henson.
I honestly think that ever since the Oscars... Remember, we talked about this on the Oscars Pop Rocket, about his over-delivery of just... announcing an award. I think this was him, his trying to redeem himself by taking it a little bit more subdued. And then he cannot find a natural balance. He's also probably embarrassed about how he's created this new math and has yet to present any like solid paper or findings on what this new math was supposed to.
What What's do you mean new math?
You haven't heard this?
One times one
is three or something. An article in Rolling Stone where he says he's created a new version of math. And one times one is two. And he's figured it in this is he's gone through the numbers. He went to he was what was he studying?
Well, if he's gone through the numbers, I mean,
he's studying to be like an engine. He studied to be an engineer. I think he's trying to figure out why bubbles aren't square. And, you know, so he's probably just trying to work that.
How much is Lee Daniels going to kill off Lucius Lyon? Like,
I don't think so. I don't think you can get rid of him at this point. I mean, it was easy to get rid of him in Iron Man because, you know, that was Iron Man. But, like, I honestly, you can't get – I'm still trying to swallow the fact that Wesley Snipes was the original Lucius Lyon. Like, that
oh,
was –
Oh, really?
Yes.
I could see that, no?
Yeah, not to detract. Sorry, we're just derailing, okay. But we'll go back to that.
The one presenter who really knocked it out of the park was John Oliver. I felt like that man was – a couple of people were tweeting that he was auditioning to host the Emmys next year. And, like, you know, as somebody who's been tucked away on HBO and doing good work, I think he really showed us that above and beyond being super funny and having a distinctive style, he is not scared to try. He is not scared to – punch that copy up and come out there and, like, take a swing at it.
It's true. Just on enthusiasm alone, he gets some points. Brownie points.
Is there anyone who you think is, like, an obvious pick to host the Emmys that we should be thinking about in future? Do you want to put anybody out there?
Mindy Kaling.
I mean, Mindy Kaling would be really fun. And she, like, with really crappy, like, presenter copy, it's just... She was able to give life to it, and that was so rare and nice last night.
Yeah.
So going from comedy to the late night shows, like, there was a lot of farewell to Jon Stewart last night. Not a whole lot of attention paid to Letterman going off of the air, but it really felt like it was all of us, like, blowing a goodbye kiss to Jon Stewart. Is this closure?
Well, I think the reason Letterman didn't get that much attention is because really, like, the spirit and fire and the vitality of Letterman left a while ago.
Yeah.
Like, it was sort of running on steam and hot air. And I feel like Jon Stewart stayed pretty vital up until the very end and really left on, like, a pretty high note. And so I think he's still just much more in everyone's thoughts and everyone's wondering what he's going to do next. I mean, yeah, I think that's part of why that happened that way.
I also really love that when you had, like, best late night writing, it was a parade of dudes and two ladies coming up. But when you have best show and you include the, like, guest producers, then suddenly you have gender equality on the stage. It is, you know, just the way
or
that things...
Or at least, like, the 20% that we just assume is equality.
Exactly. One last point about the show before we get into the categories. Like, we had... Standard Parade of the Dead, which for TV, like, dips into people who are just less famous. But we also had a parade of dead shows. Did you need a montage?
Oh my God.
Reminding you that Cougar Town was on the air within the last 12 months.
Thank you for bringing this up. Can I tell you something? I noticed something. This is me using that Terrence Howard new math. Most of 80% of the shows started in 2009. Literally, like, almost all of the shows had I'm so accustomed to shows either being on one season or 10.
Right.
So, like, it was so mind-boggling to me, like, thinking, like, were these just all, like, super hasty decisions post the wasn't there a strike at this point?
Yeah, that's so coming out of the strike. That's a good point.
Yes. So were these all just like, just get it on the air. Just get it on the air. Because that's what it feels like. Because I don't ever need to see Cougar Town, like, even in syndication again. And I love me some Courtney Cox. But I, like, I don't, none of these, most of the shows, minus, like, Mad Men and maybe How I Met Your Mother, just for posterity's sake, like, I don't really, didn't care. Like, I wasn't, like, sat, like, cry, like, you know.
The thing that made me so mad about that montage, and I'm not, like, a spoiler freak. I'm not one of these people that's like, don't tell me about a show that went off the air 10 years ago. But, I mean, a lot of those shows are still, like, pretty fresh in our minds to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Not Cougar Town.
Yeah.
But, you know, other of those shows are fresh in our mind, and it was like, oh, okay, I guess I don't need to see the end of Boardwalk Empire because you just showed me... Thanks so much.
That's really nice. That's your fault for not watching sooner.
Okay. No, it's not.
Exactly.
So the Emmys are weird in that you have TV shows around for 10 years and they are eligible for their entire life. And it leads to this weird anachronism of things that were good or big stories 5 years ago winning everything. I just feel like there's something fundamentally anachronistic about the Emmys. Allison Janney winning for Mom, a show that no one watches because we all wanted Allison Janney to, like, come in second for, like, most Emmy awards. Like, the Veep sweep felt like a little bit of a redemption, but also not an actual funny... Like, it's a funny show, but it's not, the most laugh-out-loud show.
I think... seeing someone besides Modern Family win was refreshing.
Right. Yes.
I don't know if I needed to see. And look, I love Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I think she's fantastic on the show. But it's like 4 years in the fucking row. Like, give it to someone else at some point.
Well, and also, she's got so many other Emmys. And let's never forget, she's a fucking billionaire.
Yes.
She was a billionaire before she was on SNL. Oliver, explain the change in voting for the Emmys to everybody.
So one of the big things – I mean, this is a really major change. In the past, nominations would be – and Guy, you might know – more about this. The nominations were created by the general television academy, but the actual voting in the categories was done by like a blue ribbon panel.
It was like jury duty for old people from TV shows, where like you would have to go to a room and watch the two episodes of Will and Grace where they thought that Deborah Messing was best.
Right.
And like that was why Mad About You was always able to win, because they had stupid fucking drama episodes that were all about like cancer or a baby. And that
those were good. Remember when she cheated? When Jamie cheated?
I don't want that on a fucking multicam.
But so they now have done away with the blue ribbon panel, and now the general body can vote, which is much more like I think how the Grammys work
and the Oscars.
Yes, and there was no real easy way to predict what effect that would have. But, you know, the kind of next day armchair punditry suggested that's why John Hamm won, because he had been shut out for, 18 years in a row, apparently, on Mad Men, finally got his Emmy. It might explain.
But that literally, sorry to interrupt you, Oliver, that win felt like it just landed with a thud.
Really?
Oh, I didn't feel
that. I didn't think so at all.
He had a standing ovation.
His speech was great. He crawled on stage.
Tina
Fey got to give it to him. I mean, it was great.
But, like, after you raise this point, Oliver, I realized that there was more of a sense of sort of, like, theme and sweep to these Emmys, that basically Olive Kitteridge walked into, like, Best TV Movie and walked away with absolutely everything.
Which is a movie no one watched.
No, right. I did, and it's amazing.
Okay. Really?
Yes.
But, like,
one person.
The thing is...
No, not one person. Like, seriously.
Back in the old Blue Ribbon days, Blue Ribbon Committee, like, it was way more what does Ed Asner like? And so you had these weird, like, people from procedurals who would just, like, win Best Actor in a Drama every year. And it is exciting that, like, Game of Thrones was able to, like, step up and be like, no, everybody loves this show. It's just 1,000 times more show than any other show here. Also, did you notice, Margaret's the only other person who watches here.
Yeah.
Did you notice that everybody thanked Lena Headey particularly?
Because she is the most bombs-out actor on that show.
Yeah.
Like... I mean, besides Peter Dinklage, like, I think the two of them are, like, neck to neck.
Was she nominated for...
neck to neck.
I don't think she was nominated for Best Actress, and I think it was maybe their way of saying...
Sorry,
like,
our bad.
No, she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress.
Yeah, she was.
But
nobody got that joke at all.
No, well, I heard it. I just...
What was your joke?
You know. It was she was playing off of my neck to neck.
Oh. Okay.
I'm laughing.
So we also, like, switched which category a bunch of shows were in. Like, do you feel like it is more fair to have Orange is the New Black in drama? Do you feel like it still makes sense?
I don't think it's fair. This is fair at all.
Why?
Because it feels like they made up their own rules. Just because a show's narrative takes a turn, it doesn't mean that you can decide, well, this year it's a drama. It just makes it, it's to me, it's like so... egregious for the actual academy to allow that to happen, because now it changes the course of what people are doing with their show. They're not have to worry if they're going to be switched out into a category with 7 people versus 8. Okay. I just think that's weird.
Well, that's okay. The other thing that bothered me is I believe solidly in 5 nominations, and opening things up to 8 just feels weird and messy to me. Ever since fucking Ally McBeal, like any hour long with a couple of amusing moments in it has gone into comedy, because you're dealing with so much more significant like themes that it feels like more acting is going on. So so that stuff gets rewarded in the acting categories.
So they can hit every point.
And the people who are like really proving raw ability at comedy, like the people, you know, a Titus Burgess or, you know, a Jane Krakowski, who is on Ally McBeal.
Yes.
isn't getting rewarded for like the comedy stuff that they do. And I feel like this was a good, nice year where Transparent is still, which is barely a comedy, but it's still a comedy.
Right.
Orange is the New Black, though, I feel like is way more a soap than it is a comedy.
Yes. And it's on its way to literally like crashing and burning. So they better take advantage of all of this.
Margaret, I see.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about this. I mean, I don't have a problem at all that they switched the category. I do think that show has always had this on-the-line relationship between comedy and drama. And I think when you are a show that inhabits that kind of middle space where it dances back and forth, like, how do you make that decision? How do you make that call? I mean, the things that have happened on Orange is the New Black is not the purview of comedy, really.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of those things that have happened on the show are very much drama, and the reactions are drama. And I think on that level, you have to think, okay, this earns its drama stripes, too.
But undercutting everything that I have said is the fact that their one acting win was for Uzo Aduba, who is a comedy role. Like, Crazy Eye.
I disagree.
Okay.
I actually think she does just as much in the drama realm as comedy.
Crazy Eyes is such a fascinating character because she feels like the composition of a writer's room dealing with a poor, like, barely formed character from the pilot and giving a bunch of backstory that just seems ridiculous, but which has been made so human. The notion of this like character who is just presented as crazy black lady, then being like, no, she was raised by white parents. Like, she like has this fascinating educational background.
And she has this fascinating contrast between being like wild and uncontrollable and then also very sensitive and you know, lends her support to other members of her crew.
She had a really great speech last night, but worst speech of the night. Let's listen to it.
And let me tell you something. The only thing that separates women of color from anyone else is opportunity. You cannot win an Emmy for roles that are simply not there. So here's to all the writers, the awesome people that are Ben Sherwood, Paul Lee, Peter Nowak, Shonda Rhimes,
who was not present because none of her shows were nominated for Best Drama, but who was very much present in spirit. It was the most racially diverse nominations that the Emmys had ever had, and it was a pretty racially diverse set of wins. Wait, is it just Udo and Viola? Is that all I'm thinking of?
No, Regina won too.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah.
That was great, actually. I love
also
that.
Had a really good speech, and also just reminded everybody we should be doing more things with Regina King.
Always. Yes, always.
But Viola Davis, first black woman to win Best Actress in a Drama. I believe the only black woman to ever win Best Actress in a Comedy is Isabel Sanford, who was not funny.
Wait a minute.
Realizing that Felicia Rashad, I think she was nominated like twice, but never won an Emmy for Claire Huxtable, is bizarre. Winner, you wanted to fight with me about Isabel Sanford. I mean, it's the thing that's on everybody's minds at home.
Who did she play? I don't remember.
She was the wife on the Jeffersons.
Wheezy.
Oh, got it.
She was Wheezy.
She was a straight man.
I was going to say, she was a good straight man.
She was a good straight man. To a gay man, yes.
It is interesting to think that we have gone this far without this thing happening. But then also the weird way that, like, we had, like, 10 years ago, we had our first Best Actress at the Oscars. And there's a weird way that it doesn't cross anybody. She didn't get a standing ovation until she left. Like, people started after she left.
Who, for Viola?
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole thing was tension city for me. That's why I'm so glad she was up there. I don't know if anyone knows what it's like, so as the, you know, the colored woman in the room, to stand in front of a group of your peers who are with you and also against you is in front of national television. I don't know that experience, but she, the response in what she was providing was very palpable. There was a lot of white guilt being worked out in that
but
room.
That, that Tubman,
a lot of white guilt.
That Tubman quote was so fascinating because when she started it, I just thought she was making an analogy for her own situation. But then, like, that the hit line of that was realizing 150 years have passed and maybe nothing has changed. And, like, that it was white women with arms outstretched. It was not people who were being assholes, but also just the fact that she was still not over that line.
The levels to that speech,
yes,
are going to be something that we can write books about or theses about in the future. I mean, a USC grad will do that. There's no other feeling than standing in front of people and accepting something like that for the first time. We saw Halle Berry's reaction to it, and people immediately said she overreacted. And you don't understand. You're doing something because you're passionate about it, and all of a sudden you get rewarded for it. And then on top of that, you're the first person to get this award. There's weirdness attached to it. That's very strange to me. It didn't even occur to me until I saw it that this was true. The first Black woman in 66 years. Then she's the first Black woman since my mother was in diapers?
Well,
that's insane.
There's also the dynamic of when you're the first, like, the weird tension with other people who may have deserved it and didn't get that recognition. And I, like, her referencing the Black women who are leads on dramas right now was wonderful. Taraji P. Henson standing and giving love and support was just the most beautiful thing. And, like, celebrating that, it made me a little sad for Kerry Washington because we all thought it was going to be Kerry Washington, didn't we?
But did you see her face? I mean, she was also just, like, really feeling the moment.
Well, and also that it was a win for Shondaland and
yes,
a win for, like, the fact that, I mean, the point of you can't win for roles that aren't there. And sort of recognizing the way that, like, Shonda Rhimes is responsible for what percentage of the people of color and women of color on television right now?
Like, all of them, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
But also that it's been sort of, like, teaching us that will get eyes, that, like, people of any race are interested in fascinating stories.
Yeah, you know, the whole speech made me think about, you know, recently I interviewed Gina Davis, who has this film festival coming up that is focusing on gender and diversity and getting more people in front of the screen actor-wise, but then also behind the screen.
I loved shitting on the concept of the Gina Davis Institute for Gender in the Media. Like, I made so many jokes about it the first year or two that it existed until it started doing all of the best work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the research alone that they've done is God's work. You know
yes,
what I mean? And from talking to her about how this is still something that's not happening enough on TV and that it actually makes a difference to children who see it, because that's what the Gina Davis Institute targets in particular is children's programming, actually. Mm-hmm. And I just thought about all the little girls who watched that speech and who actually thought, oh, this may be something I can do with my life, too.
Right.
You know, and I think that's huge and important and really is another angle on that speech.
Well, and also showing them narratives of being a political consultant or a law professor or all of these things that, you know, maybe weren't worlds that you understood yourself having a narrative in.
Right.
And, like, learning those narratives is so empowering. Did you see In a World?
Yes.
Oh. Gina
yeah,
Davis
right,
cameo in a World is
yes,
just, I wish I had been in a theater show.
Total mic drop kind of cameo.
It was amazing. Oliver.
I just want to add very quickly, one of the things I really just love about not just Davis's speech, but in general, the ways in which you've had people be very vocal about issues of inclusion, about issues of diversity, about sort of just the uber whiteness of Hollywood is that it prevents the sort of well-meaning liberal wing of Hollywood it doesn't allow them to kind of skip ahead to, like, the colorblind part, which is what they want to get there And they don't want to acknowledge all of the problems in casting that, and we've certainly talked about on this show. And I think I'm sure Davis's speech probably pissed off a certain segment, you know, within Hollywood, probably thought was inappropriate to bring stuff like that up. But I'm just glad that people are out there pushing it because as long as you keep it in, as long as you keep it out there, you can't. It doesn't allow anyone to kind of avoid that topic. You know what I mean? So
going in and pitching and having networks tell me that like their viewers are so cool that they are post gay, so we really shouldn't have any gay narratives. It is like, well, no, you're saying that a problem is over just because you don't want to have to deal with it. That said, I do like we've seen the cast and creators of Transparent like tip the hat to the trans community so much, but continuing to watch a cis man and a cis woman get up there. And, like, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful show, and Jeffrey Tambor does wonderful work. And I know that they will continue to work hard to try to pimp the trans writers and trans actors who they have worked to get on the show. But there is something a little bit white knighty about the way that it exists right now.
But can I just say, Jill Holloway's award show outfits?
Oh.
Between this, the globe, I mean, homely.
The polka dot also, suit. I mean, I'm going to have to revamp my feelings about
polka
dots.
Too? God.
And Jill is heterosexual, but like was aesthetically throwing Power Lesbian really hard. And just an evening for Power Lesbians. Like the Olive
Kitchen. Lisa Cholodenko.
Yes, Lisa Cholodenko killing it. That lovely woman who won for the screenplay of Olive Kittredge, Jane something or other. I have a list. I should look at it. But before we go, a moment for dresses.
Yes.
Were there...
Allison Janney. Hot lava.
That was a great dress.
Oh, my God.
She wore that thing beautifully.
We didn't talk about... Where is Jennifer Westfeld?
Oh.
She was thanked very discreetly in sort of a blanket.
She was
of
Jen
people.
At the end, yes.
Yeah.
But she wasn't going to be there because that relationship is over. She stayed on that mechanical bull as long as a person could. We're talking about John Hamm's former wife.
Yeah. I mean, John Hamm, that speech, though, I loved it because it really felt like, oh, he's going through some stuff right now.
Yeah. He's been at, like, comedy shows a lot recently. And he's like...
Oh, really?
He's always hung out around comedy shows, but it's still like, oh, wow, what's going on? dresses that I thought were amazing. Well, first of all, just wanted to know, a lot of people with metal chains as straps... there was a lot of that going on, but
like who had that going on?
There were two people.
It was Claire Danes.
Claire Danes, exactly. And there was one
looked fantastic.
And there was a supporting actress I thought who had that going on, but for me it was Kerry Washington with her like barely there chainmail. Mm. And whoever this.
So Margaret Cho said if she wore that she'd look like a bag of chains.
And then the screenwriter for Olive Kittredge, whose name I can't find, was just wearing that gorgeous orange with like a slight bustle to it.
She was so cute.
She was adorable and just like a wisp of a person. adorable.
Who wore the light bright dress toward the end?
Oh, no. That was so great. Oh. I'm so glad you brought that up. It was Ben, what's his name from the OC, and some girl I had never heard of before whose name was like Mackenzie or Michaela. And I was like... What are they even doing? And then all they were doing was introducing the best guest actor in a drama so he could, like, bring someone up. And I was like,
right.
Yeah, what was with that double intro deal?
They're just trying to save time, but it still took up time. Oh, so.
Hey, did they come under time, by the way?
They came in perfectly on time. I want to make 2 points. First point is...
Hats off on that.
I love when best director for a variety TV show gets on stage... You know he is going to perfectly hit his time because he's been in the booth. He does not.
Yeah.
He will not be the person, and it is always a he, I'm sorry, yeah. Who makes that show go over. But also, what a well-directed show that they so flawlessly went into killing the packages. Like they, for the last third, they killed the nominee packages and just read the names. Mm. But it went so flawlessly, you didn't even notice it. And it like...
Yeah, it was tight ship.
It was a tight show. They had two shitty video sketches. I mean, it's Andy Samberg. He should have been able to give us better, but like, it wasn't too much. Oliver.
Can we get to the bad dresses?
Yes.
Joan Cusack with that...
When she walked out... No, Oliver, good for you. When she walked out on stage, I was like, that silhouette is great. Like, she's so tall. Like, she's not 30 anymore. Like, what a great way of looking gorgeous. And then the way it cut her across the bust, like, it had this, like, keyhole-y thing that, like, perfectly made you go like, what are her boobs doing?
In a
way that was terrible.
Go in, Winter, go in.
I just want to talk about, I know she was the darling of the night, and I love her. I really do. And she is really representing for us girls who don't always have it 100% together and are not fashionistas. But Amy Schumer.
Oh, my God.
Literally.
Her look. It was full on walk of no shame.
Yes.
Yes.
And the thing is if it was just fitted a little bit wrong because I feel
she had no jewelry on. It was like she got up and just pulled on that dress and like frizzed out the hair and was like, all right.
What it was doing
to her. And she also looked like she was at Roscoe's House of Chicken and Waffles for like the entire afternoon before she booked it to the Nokia or the Kodak or wherever.
Both she and Amy Schumer had dirty hair and like
Poehler,
Amy Poehler,
like and them presenting together, it was like ugh. But like the thing to understand, Margaret, from my days at Fashion Police, is that hair up, strapless. No neck jewelry and no dangly earrings makes me want to punch you and your stylist.
Because it's so predictable and safe.
And it's just, you're just leaving all of this territory. And I realize it started from Jennifer Aniston being like, look at how beautiful and athletic and bronzed I am. I don't need an accessory here. No, everyone needs a fucking accessory there. Have on a necklace or at least some droopy earrings.
I think they call them dangly, not droopy.
Drop earrings. But this is the thing. Like, I don't want to criticize another woman who's not as picture perfect when we're trying to be in a world, exist in a world where women aren't always perfect and can still win. But there was just, it was too much happening and it was very distracting.
Well, and the thing is if you, like, she's gorgeous. And if you put and if you put it together right, all I would be saying is them titties. But it was a little bit off, though. Her like paying tribute to Jessie Kline, telling her to make that show, and really honoring the very special role that Jessie Kline has in making that show. And Jessie Kline wearing like a dress with like another dress over it because she just had a baby was pretty fucking adorable, even though she is tiny.
And cred to her makeup person for doing the smoky eye, which is a very hard thing to pull off.
All right, you guys, you are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back after this.
Hi, everybody. I'm Justin McElroy.
I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Griffin McElroy, and this is our serious promo. No horsing around, you two.
If you like just three gentlemen being adults about topics and giving advice for them to them, My Brother, and Me is the podcast for you, serious-minded adults.
No monkey shines, no fall to roll.
Hey, let me ask you a question. How sophisticated is your palate?
You like Merlot?
Our show is basically like the Merlot and Dark Chocolate of podcasts.
You gotta be grown up to like them.
Our podcast is Toilet Wine.
Listen to the Toilet Wine of podcasts every Monday right here at MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Michael Branum, Esquire. With me in the studio are...
Oliver Wang, PhD.
Oh.
I don't even know what to say now. Margaret Louise Wappler.
Winter?
Winter Patrice Mitchell, SBF.
What is SBF?
Single Black Female.
Well, Single Black Female, every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what is your current jam? Winter, what is your current jam?
Ooh, this one is called Recognize by Party Next Door. The reason why I love this song, besides, you know, how I feel about Drake, even though I don't understand what he says sometimes, this artist is Canadian, so this is like somebody that he's like hip-pocketing, taken under his wing, and the beginning of the song sounds like a horror movie, synths from the 80s. It's like all synthed out, so it's a couple of songs mixed together to make a sample, but this is another week for quadrants being hit.
All right, let's hear it.
All fired, yeah. Better recognize when I see you. I really want you. Hit the club for you. Light skin got his new do. Even look like low too. I be tripping with this money, ayy. Hit the strip, check my money, lane. Sorry if my work covered in dank. Cause I've been rolling with skunk all day. All these bitches know the shit.
Why is it great?
He's basically telling somebody, I just want you. I don't care about this. He calls him the N-word, but he's like, I don't care about this dude. I don't care about that dude. I don't care about... All I want is you. So he's basically saying, to get to you, I will blow through 4 or 5 different Negroes just to get you into my life. I just like the beat.
It's a beautiful sentiment. Margaret, what is your jam?
My jam is from the other half of Andy Samberg, his wife, Joanna Newsom.
Oh,
yeah.
That San Francisco harp lady.
That's right. San Francisco harp lady. She has a new song out called Leaving the City. And if you've ever wanted to attend a Prague concert in Middle Earth, this is as close as you're going to get. So let's hear a little bit of it.
Oh, we leave in the city on the black road through the gold.
Why is this not an Elvish? This is what I want to know. It sounds like it should be an Elvish.
Yeah, it's definitely got some elfin vibes. It was very funny watching your face, Oliver. It reminded me of those like YouTube videos of the dog making the perplexed, like, what is that sound in the distance? Kind of, yeah. It's definitely like, I mean, some people are going to hear this and they're going to hate listen and some people love her. And I feel like she's a real divider like that. You either just buy in 100% with the harp and all of the grandeur that comes with it, or you're just like, come on, lady, you know, get into the real world. But I love and respect Joanna Newsom because I think no one else sounds like her. And I think she's willing to make really bold, weird decisions that most artists would be scared shitless to do. So on that level, respect. That's from an album coming out called Divers.
That sounds like something that Andy Samberg would have made fun of in the skit on SNL.
Exactly.
You know, which is, I know what you mean. And it's funny to think about, like, what they talk about and if she, like,
yes,
runs her songs by him. Like,
you're literally taking the words right out of my mouth.
Were they high school sweethearts? I forget. How did they do?
No. Just, like, met probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago and got married pretty quick.
Got it.
Yeah, I don't understand how anybody's relationship works. All right. My jam this week is not a jam. It is just a talking point for us to be able to have a brief conversation. Mm-hmm. Amicably. Here's a little bit of Ryan Adams deciding to
here we go.
Remove.
Here we go.
I decided to go with the one I like most.
I was trying to ignore this whole thing, but go on.
I'm sorry. Here's the blank space.
Nice to meet you, baby. I can show you incredible things. Magic, madness, heaven and sin. Saw you there and I thought, oh my God, look at that face. You look like my next mistake. Love's a game, do you wanna play?
So about 7 years ago, for 1 week, I was the night editor of Gawker, and it was the golden age of like hipster covers of my humps, and I wrote a thing that was basically me getting very mad at people for depopifying pop, like, which I feel like in a my hump situation is more clearly like shitting on, oh, they are using non-standard English and talking about sex things, aren't they stupid and worse. I can't bring myself to hate this Ryan Adams thing because it's fine. It's just not fun. And, like, I really feel like Shake It Off is the place where it really is. What are you doing here, dude? Like, you've taken a song that is about, like...
exuberance and...
Exuberance and also about problems that aren't yours. Like, problems that aren't yours. And, like, of course it's going to come off as inauthentic because people don't say that you stay out too late and go on too many dates, you know? Though he dated Parker
Posey. Actually, I was going to say, people do kind of say that
okay.
about him.
But
he's a little bit of, like, a man-ho.
Is he a man-ho? Oh, we got to talk about that later. Come on.
Why did he do this?
Because it's a really good way to get your name in the papers and still be able to thank you for that cosign, Oliver. It's a really good way to get yourself in the papers and notoriety if you haven't really had anything successful happen to you lately and you need a boost. And it's also a good way to show off how talented you are. I mean, Ryan Adams is very talented. So, I mean, it's...
Winter,
it's
do you think it would have been a stronger strategy just to convince people that he was Bryan Adams?
Thank you.
Yes!
Someone has to make that joke. If it was... Had to be someone here.
Understandable. Oliver, what are your thoughts?
I didn't have a problem with it. I don't necessarily like it, as you pointed out, Guy. It's not a particularly fun album to listen to. But I don't think he was doing this in kind of the twee ironic way, which is what people covering my humps were doing. It was sort of poking fun at it. This to me seemed fairly sincere, but it also doesn't seem difficult to take any one song in any genre and then switch genres on it. I mean, you could do metal versions of Dylan if you wanted to. I think the kind of the question is, why would you bother? And so to me, this is
– sometimes it can be transformative in a way that is transcendent. Look, American Idol would periodically give somebody like – they would like take a Beatles song and like remove it to their genre. And I would be like, wow, this is new and different and great. And admittedly, you were starting out with a Beatles song there. But this just felt like, I don't know, guitar noodling and words that we've heard before.
It's like a YouTube series that somehow got made into an album. In other words, some guy's like sitting like, here, I'm just going to do a bunch of like, you know, mopey rock versions of 1989, except it's Ryan Adams, and therefore he can actually get a little bit more publicity behind, as Winter points out. But I don't really see what the point is of it, but I'm not offended by it.
Oliver, you make the good point that the future of media is terrifying, and Black Mirror was convincing us that it was all going to be pig fucking, but it turns out more just being gently bored.
No, wait, have you not been following the David Cameron thing?
It was like kind of going to be part of my all about, but for those of you who haven't heard, we found out that the current Prime Minister of Great Britain, while he was at Oxford, stuck his dick in a pig's mouth. And
dead pig's mouth. That's the accusation.
I mean, everybody is now coming forward and basically saying, like, yeah, it happened. It was part of his weird
some initiation ritual into a secret club.
Yeah, he's part of a secret rich kid.
I don't think Black Mirror was wrong in this assumption. I think somebody had some inside
information. Yeah, I think that's a good call.
I'm loving this.
Yeah.
Now.
All right, Oliver, what's your jam?
Blackalicious is back for the first time in 10 years, which kind of blows my mind. And their new album is called Imani, and this song's called We Did It Again.
Once upon a time, reality was black and white. Couldn't fit in with the younger kids in parties after nightfall. Felt like they was giving instructions how to handle life. While I felt my way through darkness and I didn't have a light. Then I felt a thing, something that would ignite all. Energy within above my head appeared a light bulb. Soon enough the mic call. Soon enough the nightclub. Gathered as I rapidly knew that I found the right one.
Is it 1987 again?
Or probably more like, I didn't say 94, but sure. Your joke actually raises something I've been struggling with for a long time, which is how do I listen? What is the best practices of listening to groups that were incredibly formative to me, you know, in the 1990s? And certainly Blackalicious is part of that. My website blog, Soulsides, was directly, I ripped off the name of Blackalicious's first label, which was called Soulside, just spelled differently. I've been a huge fan of Gift of Gab and Chief Excel since the 90s. And I was listening to this album at the same time I was going back and forth between it and Mac Miller's new album. Mac Miller is basically of the generation of people who grew up listening to Blackalicious. And you can clearly hear that influence. And just trying to figure out, do I like the Mac Miller album a little bit better overall as an album because Mac Miller's younger and newer and seems to be speaking in a more contemporary idiom, for lack of a more eloquent way to put it. And whereas the Blackalicious album, which many parts of it I like, and I really like the one song that we just played there, but part of it also feels a little bit out of time. And I can't figure out, is that me? Is that them? And I think just as in sort of a middle-aged hip-hop listener who's been listening to this stuff for almost 30 years now, it's just hard to figure out, like, how am I supposed to listen to this at this point?
Well,
what am I supposed to be listening to?
There's also the very interesting factor that the things that were formative to us 1990 to 1997 are now returning on the grand 20-year cycle of our pop culture. Mercury is in, or no, Jupiter, Saturn returning? Is it Saturn returning?
Every 28 years.
Saturn return is, I think 29. Okay. But, yeah.
I don't know what I'm talking about. point is, like, you have, like, retro cycles that are bringing stuff into your world that are also weirdly reminiscent and soothing and disquieting at the same time.
Thank you. That's a much better way of putting that.
Sorry. Do they make, like, references that are now references? Like musically or lyrics wise,
I'm trying to think. Not real. Not off of the top of my recollection. But the album very much is a middle aged hip hop album in terms of there's a lot of reflection back on youth about. There's two different songs about the passage of time, which is very telling because, again, that's not something that Mac Miller's doing because Mac Miller's like 23 or something. So, yeah, I just find it sort of a fascinating way of listening to not just them but also my own middle age in the process.
Mm-hmm. Deeply angry rap about trying to get your children into preschools, yes. Like good preschools, is something I would like a lot.
And then Ryan Adams can cover that, so.
No. All right, you guys. Oh, before we go, I'm going to be at the Comedy Attic in Bloomington, Illinois in the middle of October, and I will be at the Treasure Island Music and Comedy Festival October 27th and 28th. I think those are the right dates. But if you are in either of those places, you should buy tickets and come and look at me.
Ooh, and I'm spending next Tuesday in downtown LA at the Ace Hotel for a book release party for Dust and Grooves, which is a photo book of record collectors and their collections.
Oh, awesome. So what day and time is that?
It's I think it starts at 7 and it'll go to about midnight. It's at the Ace Hotel downtown Los Angeles on the September 29th, which is a Tuesday night.
Sweet. So you guys should check it out.
Oh, and I'm on a podcast called Pop Rocket, which is every week on Wednesday.
Here's not that good, though.
Winner.
They've been falling off. Maybe.
Yeah.
That's your own private activity. Keep it like that. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with...
Winner Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wayne.
We'll post show notes every week on MaximumFun.org. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Random K, P. Suge Knight, and Pet Ricer for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group. This week, tell us what's the first thing you bought with your very first paycheck. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the Cameron apologist, Colin Anderson.
Ouch.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.